It's nice to be here today. And I first met Peter. I was teaching an AI class at San Jose State. That was my day job for 20 years, being a computer science professor. And I realized that Peter Norvig, who co-authored the book we were using, lived somewhere in the area. And so we got him to come, and he gave us a great guest lecture. I think it was about using neural nets to steer an airplane, I believe. Yeah. And then I read a news article about Google, and I saw that Peter was now the director of research here. I thought, wow, that's great. And so so I hit him up for an invitation, and here I am. So it's fun to be at Google. As a science fiction writer, you always dreamed about the future where you'd have the universal encyclopedia and all the information of the world at your fingertips. And it's worked out faster and better than I expected. It still amazes me that the internet is free and that it didn't somehow get co-opted and made into like the U.S. Post Office or something. That's kind of amazing. Anyway, today I'm going to talk about a novel I wrote recently. It's called Post Singular. And if you're impecunious, you can actually read it for free online if you go to my page, rudyrucker.com/postsingular. And but it's available in hardback as well. I got email from a lot of people when it first came out who worked at places like this, and they say, "Yeah, I read your book in my cubicle this week." So go thou and do likewise. The novel's about there's this word that I'm sure I don't have to explain to you, the singularity, and the idea being that at some time in the not too distant future there'll be this dramatic change in the science and tech of the society that we live in. And one of the first people who talked about this was Werner Vinge. He's also a computer science professor and a science fiction writer. And he made the remark that if we had good enough AI, so we had computers that were as smart as we were, then they could rapidly become smarter because we could up their RAM, up their chip speed, gang them together, assuming that the software was scalable. Big assumption, I guess. And then set them to work designing even better machines, better software, and you might get this exploding exponential curve. And in this book, I'm talking about a slightly different kind of singularity. Well, in a way, I'm talking about this, but it's funny how quickly ideas ossify in science fiction. Like now, singularity sort of means Ray Kurzweil's particular vision of what's going to happen. And you're going to shoot up nanomachines, and they're going to clean all the gunk out of your veins, and you're going to upload your brain and live inside a computer. What a great life that would be, huh? You can never leave work, you know? But the thing that always gets my goat the most, having a high-tech job, is when you've been working all day and then you have to wait for the computer to turn itself off. And it's like, I'm not done yet. You know, I'm not done yet. But anyway, so I wanted to do something a little different with the singularity here. And so I started out with a first kind of a rapid scenario. And another big inspiration was Charles Stross, who wrote an amazing book. Is a what they call a fix-up in science fiction. That is to say, it's a series of short stories that's fixed up to make a novel. It's called Accelerando. How many of you read Accelerando? Okay. And what I liked that Charles did was some science fiction writers have been saying, well, we can't see past the singularity. Now we're stuck. You know, we sort of can't write about this. And Strauss was, you know, let's just go. Let's just do it and see what happens. And that's really what science fiction, something that it's good at, is to say, let's just dig in and imagine the unimaginable. You know, if we aren't going to do it, who is? So here, the way this book is set up, there's first a sort of a bad singularity, and then a better one, and then an even better one. And the bad one, it's the sort of more conventional notion of the singularity that you hear sometimes. It's the idea, let's take Earth and grind it up into nanomachines, and we'll make the machines out of computronium, whatever that is, okay? And then it's supposedly matter that's somehow optimized for computation. Though I would submit that matter already is optimized for computation, quantum computation. That's what matter's doing all the time. But be that as it may, there's this sort of notion that you sometimes say, let's grind Earth up into a whole bunch of nanomachines, and then let's upload ourselves into this huge swarm computation. And so as not to waste any solar energy, let's put this Matryoshka sphere around the sun, so every bit of sun is being soaked up by these evil, glittering little Intel chips. And and we'll all be living in there happily ever after. Which, that's bogus at so many levels. It's something I blog about sometimes. There's a couple of problems with it. But for the sake of a novel, it's good to just say, let's see that we can do it. One of the bogus things that happens is the person who's president is an evil halfwit named Dick Dibbs. And he arranges it so only his political supporters are the ones who are going to get uploaded into the new virtual Earth. But then, fortunately, this all happens in the first or second chapter, the main character is this man called Ond, and he works at a high-tech company called Exa. Actually, it's called Nantel, and then later they changed their name to Exa. And he finds a way to reverse the Nant computation after it's eaten all of Earth. And then the Nants turn out to be reversible computers, so everything goes back to normal. And then the president is executed by lethal injection, so it's a kind of a happy situation. Then Ond still keeps working, and he wants to make a less corrosive kind of nanomachine. And he has this idea for something called ORFIDs. And it's sort of a joke on ARFIDs that you're hearing about a lot these days, you know, dust-sized RFID chips. And I want those to be here because I'm always losing things. So I want to be able to Google my possessions. Okay, I want to be able to have like an ARFID chip on everything I own and be able to find it. And privacy's gone. Why worry about privacy? Okay, I just want to know where my glasses are. And if somebody else can find them too, that's okay with me. But the ARFIDs, I call them ORFIDs here. And Ond has this idea. He's designed the ORFIDs, and this is the part I'm going to read you. It's about them. And his idea is to have them not be so furiously self-reproducing as the Nants. They'll only go up to a certain density of about 1 per square millimeter and stop. So I'm going to read you a little bit about this, and then we'll do some questions, okay? And I should explain, in the passage I'm going to read, there's two couples. There's the engineer, Ond, and there's his wife, Nektar. And then there's another couple. There's a man called Kregor, who fishes for cuttlefish in the San Francisco Bay. It's the invasive feral cuttlefish has gotten here from Burma. It's taken over the bay. And they're very lucrative because you can get the rhodopsin out of their skin, and which is this very labile chemical substance. And people are using them to wear these things like contact lenses. They're called web eyes. So you can actually see, you know, a computer display on your contact lenses. And so he's catching cuttlefish, and his wife is called Jill. And Jill is very beautiful. Okay. I used to think, and Kregor is having trouble with, he has to file reports on all the cuttlefish that he catches, and it's he's sort of complaining about this because he's not good at paperwork, being a fisherman. I used to think the feds micromanaged independent fishermen like me so that they could tell the public they're doing something about invasive species, said Kreger. But now I think they want to drive me out of business so they can sell my license to a big company that makes campaign contributions. That's where my new tech comes in, said Ond. We label the cuttlefish with radio frequency tracking devices and let them report on themselves, like barcodes or ARFIDs, but better. It's not like I get my hands on the cuttles until I actually trap them, said Kreger. So how would I label them? They're smart enough that it'd actually be hard to trap the same one twice. What if the tags could find the cuttlefish, said Ond. Pink and grinning, he glanced around the circle of faces, then reached into his pocket. Introducing the ORFIDs, he said, holding up a little transparent plastic vial. Etched onto one side were the stylized beetle and flowing cursive letters of the XAXA logo. My big surprise. Whatever was in the vial was too small to see with the naked eye, but Jill's web eyes were displaying tiny balls of light, little halos around objects in rapid motion. ORFIDs are to barcodes as velociraptors were to trilobites, continued Ond. The ORFIDs will change the world. Not another nanomachine release, exclaimed Nektar, jumping to her feet. You promise never again, Ond. They're not Nance never, said Ond, his tongue a bit thick with the beer and tobacco. They smoked an illicit cigarette. ORFID's good, Nance bad. ORFID's self-reproduce using nothing but dust floating in the air. They're not destructive. ORFID's are territorial. They keep a certain distance from each other. They'll cover Earth's surface, yes, but only down to one or two ORFID's per square millimeter. They're like little surveyors. They make meshes on things. They'll double the numbers every few minutes at first, gradually slowing down, and after a day the population will plateau and stop growing. You'll see a few million of them on your skin and maybe 10 sextillion ORFIDs on Earth's whole surface. From then on, they only reproduce enough to maintain that same density. You might say the ORFIDs have a conscience, a desire to protect the environment. They actually hunt down and eradicate any rival nanomachine that anyone tries to unleash. Sell it, Ond, said Kreger, grinning at Nektar. ORFIDs use quantum computing. They propel themselves with electrostatic fields. They understand natural language, and they're networked via quantum entanglement, continued Ond. The ORFIDs will communicate with us much better than the Nance ever did. And as the ORFIDnet emerges, we'll get intelligence amplification and superhuman AI. The secret XAXA project, mused Jill, watching the darting dots of light in the vial. You've been designing these ORFIDs all along? Sly Ond. In a way, the Nance designed them, said Ond. Before I rolled back the Nance sent Nantel some insanely great code. Coherent quantum states, human language comprehension, autocatalytic morphogenesis, a layered neural net architecture for evolvable AI. The Nance nailed all the hard problems. But Ond, said Nektar in a pleading tone, we've been testing the ORFIDs for the last year to make sure there won't be another disaster when we release them, said Ond, raising his voice to drown out his wife. And now, even though we're satisfied that it's all good, the execs won't formally pull the trigger. There's been a lot of company politics, a lot of infighting. So that's why I've gotten informal approval to go ahead and release the ORFIDs, myself. Ha, said Nektar, approval from yourself. You want to start the same nightmare all over again. She tried to snatch the vial from An's hands, but he kept it out of her reach. Nektar's symmetric features were distorted by unhappiness and anger. Her voice grew louder. Mindless machines eating everything. Mommy, don't yell, shrieked Chu. That's their son. Chill, Nektar, said Ond, fending her off with a lowered shoulder. Where's your nicotine euphoria? Believe me, these little fellows aren't mindless. An individual ORFID is roughly as smart as a talking dog. He has a petabyte of memory, and he crunches at a petaflop rate. One can converse with him quite well. Watch and listen. He said a string of numbers, a machine-coded web address, and an ORFID interface appeared within the web eyes of Chu and the four adults. The ORFIDs in the vial were presenting themselves as cute little cartoon faces, maybe 100 of them, stylized yellow smileys with pink dots on their cheeks and gossamer wings coming out the sides of their heads. "Hello, orphids," said Jill. Her daughter Bixie looked up at her curiously. To Jill, her daughter's face looked ineffably sweet and vulnerable behind the dancing images of nanomachines. "Hello, Jill," sang the orphids, their voices sounding in their listeners' earbuds. "After I release you fellows, I want you to find all the cuttlefish in the San Francisco Bay," Ahn told the orphids. "Ride them and send a steady stream of telemetry data to ftp.exaexa.org/mertzboat. "Can you show us a real cuttlefish?" the orphids asked. Their massed voices were like an insect choir, the individual voices slightly off-pitch from one another. "Those are cuttlefish," said Ahn, pointing to Kreger's holding tank. "Settle on them and we'll release them into the bay. Okay by you, Kreger?" "No way," said Kreger. "Those Pharaoh cuttlefish took me 4 days to catch. Leave them alone, Aunt." "They're my daddy's cuttlefish," echoed Kreger's son. "I'll buy them from you," said Aunt, his eyes glowing. "Market rate. The orphids will blanket your boat, too. They can map out your stuff, network it, make it interactive. That's where the publicity for your assemblagist sculpture comes in. Your assemblages will be little societies. The AI hook makes them hot." "Market rate," mused Kreger. "Okay, sure." He named a figure and Ahn instantly transferred the amount. "All right," said Kreger. "Wiretap those pharaohs and spring them from death row." "Weren't you listening to what Ahn said about the orphids doubling their numbers?" cried Nectar. "We're doomed if he opens the vial." She lunged at her husband. Ahn danced away from his wife, keeping the orphids out of her reach, his grin a tense rictus. Chu was screaming again. "Stop it, Ahn," exclaimed Jill. "Things are spinning out of control. I don't want your orphids on my boat. I don't want them on my kids." "They're harmless," said Ahn. "I guarantee it. And I'm telling you, this is going to happen anyway. I just thought it'd be fun to kick off Orphid Night in front of you guys. Be a sport, Jill." "Hey, listen up. You're our orphids. You're our friends, aren't you?" "Yes, Ahn, yes," chorused the orphids. The discordant voices overlapped, making tiny, wavering beats. "That was very nice of you to think of us, Ahn," said Jill carefully. "But you better take your family home now. They're upset and you're not yourself. Put the orphids away." "I think tracking the cuddles is a great idea," put in Kreger, half a step behind Jill, as usual. "Tagging my stuff is good, too. My assemblages can think." "Thank you, Kreger," said Ahn. He turned clumsily towards the cuttlefish tank. This time he didn't see Nectar coming. She rushed him from behind, a beer bottle clutched in her hand, and she struck his wrist so hard that the vial of orphids flew free. The chaotically glowing jar rolled across the deck. Chu caught up with the vial, and screaming like a banshee, he wrenched it open and threw it high into the air on a trajectory towards the tank. "Stop the yelling," yelled Chu. Perhaps he was addressing the orphids. "Make everything tidy." Through her web eyes, Jill saw illuminated orphid dots spiraling out of the vial in midair, the paths forking and splitting in two, and now her web eyes overlaid the scene with a tessellated grid showing each orphid's location. Some were zooming toward the cuddles, but others were homing in on the junk crowding the boats aft. Additional view windows kept popping up as the nanomachines multiplied. Jill hugged her daughter to her side, covering the slender girl's dark hair with her hands as if to keep the orphids off her. Ahn bent forward, rubbing his wrist. Kreger gave Nectar a quick embrace, calming her down, and then he stared into the tank, using his web eyes to watch the orphids settle in. "Do you at least have an undo signal for the orphids?" Nectar asked Ahn presently. "Like you did for the Nance?" Only a minute had elapsed, but the world felt different. Human history had changed for good. "Orphid computations aren't reversible," said Ahn, "because the physical world keeps collapsing their quantum states." "Decoherence." "I can't believe you attacked me like that, Nectar." "I can't believe you're ruining the world," snapped Nectar. "I want you off our boat," Jill told Ahn again. "You've done what you came to do, and for God's sake, don't spread the word that you did your release here. I don't want cops and reporters trampling on us." "Sorry," Jill replied Ahn, wiggling his fingers. His wrist was okay. "This is so historic that I'm video blogging it live. It's already on the web. Web eyes and wireless, you know." Kreger hustled Ahn, Nectar, and Chu onto one of the Mertz boat's piezoplastic dinghies, which would ferry them to the dock and return on its own. The dinghy twinkled with orphid lights. Watch me on the news, called Ond. Are we right to just sit around, asked Kreger? Jill asked Kreger after Ond left. Shouldn't we be calling for an emergency environmental cleanup? I feel itchy all over. The feds would trash our boat and it wouldn't change anything, said Kreger. The genie's out of the bottle for good. He glanced around, scanning their surroundings with his web eyes. Those little guys are reproducing so fast. I see thousands of them, each of them marked by a dot of light. They're mellow, don't you think? Look, I might as well put those cuttlefish in the bay. I mean, Ond already paid me for them, and there's orphans all over the place anyway. What the hey, free the cuttlefish. He got busy with his scoop net. Jill's web-eye grid of orphid viewpoints had become a dish-like Escher tessellation, which was thousands of cells wide, with the central cells big, the outer cells tiny, and ever more new cells growing along the rim. The massed sounds of so many orphids was all but unbearable. I hate their voices, said Jill, half to herself. Having the voices in her head made her feel a little high, and after all her work on recovery from pseudo-coke addiction, she'd learned to dread that feeling. Being a little high was never enough for Jill. She always wanted to go all the way into the black hole of oblivion. Is this better? Came a smooth baritone voice from the orphids. The many had become one. You actually do understand us? Jill asked the orphids. A few of the orphids' eye images slewed around as Kreger carried his first dripping net of cuttles to the boat's low gunwale and lowered them to the bay waters. We understand you a little bit, said the voice of the orphids, and we'll get better. We wish the best for you and your family, Jill. We'll always be grateful to you. We'll remember your boat as our Garden of Eden, our Alamogordo test site. Don't be scared of us. I'll try, said Jill. In the unadorned natural world, her children were cheering and laughing to see the freed cuttlefish jetting about in the shallow waters near the boat. Maybe this is going to be okay, Jill, said Kreger. Maybe, said Jill, letting out a deep, shaky sigh. She poured herself a cup of hot tea. Look at my cup, she observed. It's crawling with them. An orphid every millimeter. They're like some endlessly ramifying ideal language that wants to define a word for every single part of every worldly thing. A thicket of meta-language setting the namers at an ever greater remove from the named. Her mind was teeming with words. It was like the orphids were making her smarter. Her hand twitched. Some of her tea spilled onto the deck. Now they're mapping the puddle splash, bringing it under control, normalizing it into their bullshit consensus reality. Our world's being nibbled to death by nanoducks, Kreger. We're nano-fucked. Profound, said Kreger. Maybe we can collaborate on a show. A web page where users find new arrangements for the Mertz boat inventory, and if they transfer to payment, I physically lug the objects into the new positions. And the orphids figure out the shortest paths. Or wait, we get some piezoplastic sluggies to do the heavy lifting and the orphids can guide them. I'll just work and bring in more junk. I'll be this lovable sage and the Mertz boat can be like my physical blog. And you can dance and be beautiful and at the same time intoning heavy philosophical raps to give our piece some heft. Men are immediately going to begin using the orphids to look at the exact intimate details of women's bodies, said Jill with a shudder. Can you imagine? Ugh. No publicity for me, thanks. Kreger spoke no response to this. He lowered the rest of the pharaohs into the bay. A fisher of Mertz, a fisher of men. Peace, dear cuttlefish. The empty dinghy swam back towards them, orphid lit like a fairy, nosing up to its mooring on the side of the Mertz boat. Spooked by the dinghy, the skittish cuttlefish maneuvered and changed colors for safety. The skins were thoroughly bespeckled with orphid dots outlining their bodies' voluptuous contours. Voluptuous, said Jill. I didn't say that out loud, did I? Said Kreger. Geez, you're picking up on my sub-vocal mutters. This orphanet link is like telepathy almost. I better be a good boy. I learn how to damp down your access to my activities. Whoops, did I say that out loud too? There's meshes all over you, Jill, in case you didn't know. Already, said Jill, holding out her hand. She'd been ignoring the changes to herself and her family, but now she let herself see the dots on her fingers, dots on her palms, dots all over her skin. The glowing vertices were connected by faint lines with the lines forming triangles.
A fine mesh of small triangles covered her knuckles. A coarser mesh spanned the back of her hand. The computational orphanet was going to have real-time articulated models of everything and everyone, including the kids. Yes, the orphans had peppered Momotaro and Bixie like chicken pox. Oh, this was happening way too fast. God damn that aunt. Jill knelt beside her daughter, trying to wipe one of the dots off her daughter's smooth cheek, but it wouldn't come loose. By way of explanation, the orphan showed her a zoomed-in schematic image of a knot of long-chain molecules, an individual orphan. They are far too tiny to dislodge. We're like cuttlefish in a virtual net, said Kreger, shaking his head. He sat down next to Jill on the deck, each parent holding one of the kids. Look out there, said Jill, pointing. The orphans were twinkling in the bay waters, on the bridges and buildings of San Francisco, and even on the foothills and mountains surrounding the bay. Jill and Kreger hadn't really believed it when Ond had said it would only take a day for the orphids to cover Earth, but everything as far as the eye could see was already wrapped in meshes of orphid dots. I don't know whether to shit or go snowblind, said Kreger, forcing a hick chuckle. Where does that expression come from? Like, why those two particular options? I'm so scared, said Jill in a tight voice. I don't know if I can do this. All these head trips, they make me want to use again. I want to turn myself off. Just relax, Jill, said Kreger. How about the way Ond and Necker were fighting? What a pair of lovebirds, hey? I guess Choose puts them under a lot of stress, said Jill weakly. Yeah, said Kreger, patting Jill's cheek. I enjoy Ond, but please, don't be a geek and a drunken maniac. And this is the same guy who saved Earth 3 years ago. Weird. Did you notice the way Nectar was talking about her new friend, Jose? I can see an affair taking shape. Adultery is going to be an open book with orphids tracking every inch of everyone's body. Maybe people will just start accepting it more. The world as they'd known it was over, but Kreger was gossiping as if nothing about human nature would really change. You okay? He said, wrapping his arm around Jill. Oh, Kreger, said Jill, leaning her head on her husband's familiar shoulder. Always be here for me. I'd be lost without you. Drained by shock and fear, the two of them dozed off there, sitting on the soft deck with the kids. So I think I'll stop there. And take some questions. I see this book as sort of, it's, when you write science fiction, you're writing about the present, usually. So what I'm writing about here, it's a different way of looking at what's going on right now. Like, the idea of having GPS markers all over the place so you can locate things. And so then, what if we have a GPS marker every millimeter apart? So everything becomes covered by a mesh, and you can see everything. And how does that change people's behavior? In a science fiction novel, I often think of science fiction novels as like thought experiments. You set up a situation, and then you go into that world, and you simulate it for a sustained amount of time and see what happens. Are you all like stunned? Can somebody ask you a question? Okay.
When you run simulation, you like to get some ideas of the error bounds, so maybe you run the same simulation multiple times.
Uh-huh.
And also you accept whatever outputs you get, rather than saying, well, not only does it have to be simulation, but it also has to tell a good story and so on. So how does that affect the experiments you do in writing a book?
Well, that's an interesting question. Nobody's ever asked me that question. I always say that science fiction is a thought experiment, and you're saying yes, but when you're doing a novel, you're not really doing a totally free simulation because you have the constraint of making a good story, and also you only do it once. Sometimes I will take a topic that interests me and write multiple stories about it. But
make it a usable, a good story, that's sort of, you sort of have to do that. Otherwise, well, that's the fun of it. It's what makes writing hard is there's so many things that can happen, and then to sort of sculpt it into a sort of seemly form. People often run into this when they try to write their life story. I was mentioning to Peter at lunch, I'm retired from teaching now, and it seems like a lot of retired people I know, they say, I'm going to write my autobiography. And then they always encounter this problem that a written document is linear, and your life is anything but linear. It's hyperlinked, it's fractal, it's branching, everything reminds you of something else. And so that's the craft of writing is about finding a way to make a path that sort of feels right and has a shapely curve to it. Yeah?
One negative characteristic of Golden Age science fiction, in my opinion, is that the women are just props.
And yes.
I was stunned by what you said in introduction to your book, especially because I've read other, you know, here are the men, these are their careers, here are their wives, one is very beautiful. Is the rest of the book like that? Is your book not a good choice for me, or was that just that one section?
Well, I guess I left myself open for that one, didn't I? Actually, Jill is a really interesting character. She's a recovering addict. She's a product. She starts as a product dancer, and then she becomes this sort of very powerful person who does this sort of guerrilla attack on this company. Sort of like Intel, and blows it up where the Nants are coming from. So I guess when I think about Jill, I tend to think about how beautiful she is. But I do make a considerable effort to make my women be strong characters. Yeah, I think that's actually something I'm pretty good at. Nectar also is quite a powerful character. She does a lot of stuff. I mean, she clobbered on with a beer bottle already, but she's a chef. She runs a restaurant. She does a lot of cool things. So, I think it would be safe to say that I'm one of the less sexist science fiction writers that there are. Okay, because I have I've been married 40 years and I have two daughters, and I've put up. I've interacted with women a lot over the years. So I think I started to say put up there. I'm hanging myself again. Okay. But check it out. One of the main characters in this book is a woman called Thuy Nguyen. And she's also the hero of the second one. The sequel to this is called Hylozoic. That relates to the idea that everything could be alive. That's an actual Wikipedia word, hylozoism. It's this philosophical belief that objects could be alive. Because something, like maybe some of you have this feeling too, of being tired of digital machines. It's like you've seen enough of them. And I have this dream of analog computation, quantum computation somehow replacing digital computation. So we could be using brute matter as our computers. The only problem with that is the interface. It's hard to... I mean, if I have just any ordinary object, a stone. The stone is... the atoms are vibrating. There's phonons traveling around inside there. There's a huge amount of computation going on. But it's the input-output problem. How do you get information in and get it out? But at the end of Post-Singular, I have them find a way to do that. And so in Hylozoic, it's sort of like a gnat world, but all the objects are alive. And as I say, one of the main characters in there is Thuy Nguyen. Thuy's very cool. I can show you a picture of her if you like. Let's see. I think if we go here. Yeah. One thing I took up recently was painting. I wrote a novel about the painter Peter Bruegel. It's the only science fiction novel I've written. And then I started doing paintings of my books while I was working on them. And there's this series of... This is a picture of... and what I do is I get the images and I post them online at this place called ImageKind, so you can theoretically buy prints of them. Not that many people do. So this is a kind of a big zoom. That's the back of Tweedwind's head. She's got two pigtails, see? And let's see if we can get a smaller picture. Maybe that'll show her. And that's a flying alien. They're not bad, necessarily. They're called the Hrull. They're flying stingrays. And the person riding inside it is Chu. And that guy, I guess that's Hieronymus Bosch. He gets involved in the novel as well. It's with science fiction, you can sort of bring in anything you like. So that's sort of a long answer to your question. I don't know if I assuaged your anxieties about my political correctness or not. Yeah?
So you mentioned earlier that you think that privacy is gone.
Yeah.
So what do you think is going to replace it, or what do you think that will happen now that privacy is gone?
I think pushback. It's like if somebody tries to hassle you about something, it'll become increasingly easy to push back at them and do the same thing to them. So it'll be maybe a little bit like, I don't know, like the Wild West, where you don't shoot somebody because they'll shoot you. Not that, I mean, I really dislike violence and guns, so maybe that's not the best metaphor, but the idea being, but if somebody's tapping you, then you can out them for whatever they're doing, because everybody's got something.
So if you have no privacy, what prevents the government from passing all sorts of obnoxious rules and actually enforcing them?
Well, that's, again, we have to go after the government. I mean, we have to vigorously go after the oppressors. We can't just drift and let them screw us. Take to the streets. You know, I mean, don't let them get a free ride for things that they're doing that are illegal. See that they're persecuted and prosecuted. And I think that hopefully would be easier in the future. Because in principle, yeah, there's enough laws that it's hard not to be in violation of something at any given time. Yeah?
All these singular books seem to like assume that everything will turn out okay once they know lots more. What about the Grace Lodge and the Grey Goo?
I didn't quite understand. Oh, the Grey Goo?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in what I was doing here was basically in the Nant scenario was kind of a Grey Goo scenario, okay, where they actually eat everything and that's it. So then, that was in the first two chapters of this book. And then I say, well, suppose nanomachines are inevitable. We'd want to have some nanomachines that acted like antibodies, like an immune system. So, like if bad nanomachines show up, there's always one of these good nanomachines around, and they will devour them. So that's the take on it.
Getting back to my earlier question, if 99% of the simulations, everybody dies in chapter 2, you can't publish any of those, and you're left publishing a book on the 1% that happens to survive.
It's like an anthropic principle of science fiction simulations. You only publish the ones where, yeah, and then they all died, you know. I don't I tend to think maybe we overestimate the fear of the gray goo problem, because after all, nanotechnology, when you get down to it, is often just another word for biology. I mean, that's what's going on, you know, with viruses. You know, they're doing things with molecules, and nature has been keeping it real for, you know, millions of years. It's evolved. And the idea is, if you say, well, I'm going to make some artificial organism, I'm going to get some naked strand of DNA, and it's opportunistic and it tries to eat things, and I'm going to set it loose, and it's going to be able to eat everything in the world. Well, nature is cunning. I mean, there's a lot of... Every virus wants to eat everything in the world, too. Every bacteria wants to eat everything in the world. I mean, the whole earth is full of things that want to eat everything, and they don't manage to do it, because there's lots of other things that they make it their business not to get eaten. So I think it would not be so easy as is sometimes feared to wipe the earth out with some sort of biotech, nanotech kind of thing. So I think the system is rather robust. And there's a tendency sometimes to overestimate what we're capable of doing. Yeah?
Constructing the narrative out of the possibilities is what we do with the story.
Yeah.
What we all do anyway with our lives.
Uh-huh.
But as everything gets more documented and recorded, there's hardly time to tell you sort of a happy narrative about yourself, because you haven't obviously documented and you can no longer erase it, so you did the ones who did.
Can you rephrase that more simply? I didn't quite understand.
So, you said as you write, you find the narrative that makes sense, that makes a good story.
Yes.
And that's effectively what we all do with ourselves. We tell the story of our lives to ourselves,
yes,
and to others.
Yes.
And have that sort of self-constructed narrative of us.
Yes.
That is our model of ourselves.
Yeah.
However, now that we're documenting everything much more,
yes,
it becomes harder to do that, because there's evidence that will contradict you.
Oh, it's harder to... Well, I think in making like a... I think I'll turn this on. Making a narrative of my life, I don't think I necessarily do it by falsifying my past. You know, I don't say that I went to Harvard, you know. But I guess there's things that I would emphasize, you know, play up more and play down more. There, it's kind of a matter of emphasis. One thing kind of tangentially related to your question that's always interested me is this idea of accumulating enough data about yourself on your website so that it becomes, in some sense, a simulacrum of you. And I mentioned this to Peter at lunch, just something I was thinking about lately. If you do like a Google search specifically of your website, it's with just a little bit of front end, you should be able to make something. Like suppose I had all my novels on my website, which I don't, but I have some of them. And I have notes for all my novels and my talks and my blog. I blog a lot. And then you can go there and ask it a question as if you were talking to me. It's like the question you just asked. And with a small amount of AI, well, first you start with no AI at all and just do a brute search on the words in your question. And then find ones where I've written or said something relating to your question. So you can get kind of an answer like that. And then with a little more AI, you could make it a little bit... The really hard thing would be to use that database to start generating, to write my next book without me having to write it, you know. But that's a hard problem. But it gets back to that autobiography thing. Could I then make it enough so that you could talk to it and it'd be a little bit like talking to me? Peter mentioned that some people did this with Philip K. Dick. They made a big database of everything he'd written. And then you could search it, and you'd get sort of an answer to your question. So that's the kind of answer I just gave you. Yeah?
Speaking of brute searches, the singularity in AI, I've seen a couple examples recently where... I can't remember the specifics. One of those was at a tech talk here, where some but he tried to come up with some smart AI to solve some problem, and then somebody else comes along and does a really dumb algorithm but has terabytes of data and comes up with a better, smarter system. And it seems like a lot of the attempts to come up with AI are getting beaten by, you know, fairly dumb systems that just have lots and lots of data.
Yeah, I really think that's true. That strikes me. I mean, particularly the example I've just been talking about, simulating a person. Like, rather than making up a very complicated description of their beliefs, you know, and some sort of if-then system, if you can just get, yeah, terabytes of things that they said or did, then you can just search that. That seems like, it's not elegant, but it seems like it would work pretty well. Again, that's something we'll see more of. People will do this thing, like that guy, what's his name, Bell? Who records everything that he says, Gordon Bell. And then there's even been great B science fiction movies about this kind of thing. You sort of record your whole life, and then it's easy enough to use that to simulate behaviors that you would do. So, yeah. And that's something you guys are helping to do. So I think that's cool. I always wonder if you could physically Google the world, would there then be ads on everything? Would there be an ad on my glasses when I found them? I don't know.
The Google answer would be that ads that you don't want to see are not making anybody money.
Uh-huh.
Ads that you do want to see...
they don't bother you.
That's right.
Yeah. So where to get better glasses, or
yes,
where to go once you find your glasses. Suggestions.
Right.
We just need to change the word. Yeah. Where to get the little chain. Okay. Well, I think I've used up about as much time as we have here. So thanks for having me, and thanks for coming.